Well, Glyn, thank you so much for joining me. Maybe I can leave you to the introductions. Can you introduce yourself for me?
Yeah, my name's Glyn Morgan. I'm originally from Wales, but I've lived most of my adult life in the United States, where I am currently teaching in Syracuse University, which is in New York State. And I am there the director of the Moynihan Center of European Studies and teach classes on European politics primarily.
And that double perspective across the Atlantic is the centre of your book, but also the conversation that we're about to have. I love a good origin story. So perhaps you could tell me how American Europe begins.
Yes.
And I know that there are various places that we could pick, but I'm going to ask you to begin with the Marshall Plan.
The Americans, at a fairly early stage in the Second World War, start formulating plans for what post-war Europe will look like. And they're quite interesting because Americans entertained a wide range of possible plans for Germany, for example. I think that the Americans themselves would have been quite surprised in 1945 just how involved they were going to be in post-war Europe. And they got involved in post-war Europe because they were fearful that Europe was going to collapse economically and that the Soviet Union was just going to march in. And so the United States became very, very committed to the economic development of Europe. They thought that Europe needed to have economic growth. And the Marshall Plan was first formulated in 1947, when George Marshall had spent a number of weeks in negotiations with the Soviet Union about the post-war nature of Europe, and found that the Soviet Union was quite happy to see Europe descend into economic chaos. And they thought that was in the Soviets' interest. And so the Americans decided, we can't let that happen. We need to do something to bolster European economic growth. And so they formulate what came to be known as the Marshall Plan. And in June 1947, George Marshall, Secretary of State, gives a talk at Harvard and says, we are going to fund a plan for economic growth in Europe. And that's the origin.
So to ask the Monty Python question, what has American Europe ever done for us?
Well, I think that's a nice way of putting it. But I think that if you try to run a counterfactual of what would have happened in 1948, had the United States not got involved, I think you probably would have seen the takeover of a giant chunk of Europe by the Soviet Union. And I think you wouldn't have seen the Western Germany and France and Italy being bound into a political institutional structure, which I call American Europe. And I think you have to concede that post-war Europe was something of a success. I mean, you have the Wirtschaftswunder in Germany. I mean, Europe experiences extremely high levels of economic growth for the next 30 years. And eventually, Europe becomes a fairly big player in global politics. And I think that that is the story from roughly 1945 into the 2000s. And as I'm sure we'll talk about, the United States then gets a bit worried that they've created a too strong Europe.
Well, indeed. I mean, the reason for this conversation is that we do appear to be at a moment of rupture. If you were to tell the story of this moment of rupture, what sort of moment would you pick?
I can point to a day when the rupture occurs. The day is in July 2025 at the Trump-Turnberry golf course, when the Europeans have to meet Trump at his golf course to negotiate a trade deal. And the trade deal is extremely disadvantageous to the Europeans, which is an incredible shock because the Europeans have always conceded, well, we don't have a lot of military power. We don't have a lot of so-called hard power that the other big states have. There's one power we do have, that's trade. We have the ability to go toe-to-toe with any other country, including the United States, on trade. And yet, in July 2025, the Europeans have to concede an extremely disadvantageous trade deal. Why? Because for the first time, the American president says, if you don't capitulate, essentially, we are going to withdraw our troops from Europe. We are not going to help in the battle with Ukraine. And the Europeans concede there's nothing we can do now that Trump has brought security into the equation. That event, I think, signals the end of American Europe, and a new type of political entity is taking shape, more or less, as we're talking.
That is so interesting that you picked a failed deal on a golf course, basically, because, you know, I was expecting something like the berating of Zelensky in the Oval Office or the Munich Security Conference. You know, I was expecting one of those sort of headline-grabbing, obvious geopolitical crunch points. And no, you've located us in the golf course of Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, well, not Mar-a-Lago. It's the golf course in the west coast of Scotland, which is even worse, because they've had to go all the way up to the west coast of Scotland and meet Trump at his European outpost. And there's a family. If you want to really, this is probably the wrong thing to say for a radio conversation, but if you wanted a visual picture of this, there's a wonderful photograph that takes place with Donald Trump holding up his thumb and smiling right next to Ursula von der Leyen, who's holding up her thumb and smiling. And then over on the end of the photograph, there's the Director General of Trade for Europe, a German lady called Sabine Weyand, who's extremely knowledgeable. She was the person who actually defeated Britain in the Brexit negotiations, and she's glowering. She's the one person who knows what a terrible deal they've signed. She's the one person who knows we have had to capitulate to somebody who is now leveraging security with trade.
The grubby, mercantile nature of this, you know, locates us very firmly in the world of trade deals. But there is an ideological aspect at play, isn't there?
And yes.
That, yeah. Maybe you can unpick that for me, because we're sort of shifting in your telling from the ideology of an American Europe based on transatlantic trade and rapprochement and all the rest of it into something very, very different. And that is actually, in many ways, not much to do with what's happening in Europe and everything to do with what's happening in the United States.
Yes. And I think that the key event there is the J.D. Vance speech in Munich in February 2025, where Vance really does start criticising European culture, European politics, in ways that I don't think any US political leader has ever done before. And this is the first of many types of criticisms along this. You see it now with Pete Hegseth in the D-Day celebrations, where he chose to say that back in 1944, the Europeans stood up against the dangerous ideology of fascism. They've now conceded to the equally dangerous ideologies flooding across their borders from immigrants. And the United States is here to bring the lesson of national sovereignty, to remind Europeans that global governance is a bad idea. And the Europeans really need to pull up their socks and think more about defending the Western way of life. So one of the reasons why I think we can talk about the end of American Europe, the end of a period that lasts roughly from 1945 to 2025, is that it, as you say, it combines not merely security and trade changes, but also a major cultural or civilizational divide between Europe and the United States. And the United States wants to transform European culture in an American direction, and they are pressing very hard on this.
Mm. Which, in a way, is nothing new. It's just that the direction that America has taken has shifted.
Absolutely. So I think you have to remember that America today is going through something like a cultural war internal to its own politics. There's a sense from, let's call them the MAGA right, that we've won the election, we have the presidency, we have the Senate, we have Congress, we have the judiciary. But unfortunately, we don't control America. And the reason why we don't control America is because woke liberals, or what I call in the book the Brahmin left, are in charge of the universities, they're in charge of the media, they're in charge of the civil service, they're in charge of the foreign policy. And if we in the MAGA movement want to control America, we have to fight a cultural battle against that woke liberal elite. And so that's what's going on. And Europe's got sucked into it, because Europe represents the end point of a woke liberal way of life.
Right, which is so interesting because Europe effectively becomes the bogeyman or the surface onto which all of these cliches, these Feindbilder sort of images of the enemy get projected.
Yes, absolutely.
Which made me, I was thinking a lot of Naomi Klein's doppelganger ideas, actually, when reading the book and sort of seeing how the projection of everything that you don't want to be gets projected onto another entity and then you kind of define yourself in opposition to it. And that seems to be the role that Europe is playing for America at the moment.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And it's, I'm talking to you now from London, and London figures very prominently in these battles because... London is portrayed as this very dangerous city where multicultural gangs are running amok. My neighbours were fearful of me coming to London because they'd heard so much about people having their iPhones stolen and their Rolex watches ripped from their wrists in Mayfair. And when I tell my British friends that that London is portrayed as this nightmarish hell-like situation, they're just astonished because it's a much safer city than most cities in America, and it's relatively well run and a pleasant place to be. But you're right, it's this idea that these rather abstract battles that are being waged against the woke liberals, we can make them more concrete by highlighting negative memes about Europe.
So where does this leave Europe? And I am conscious that when I say Europe, there are many Europes, and there is an increasingly strong Europe that is right on board with exactly the kind of ideologies that we've just been discussing.
Yes.
So I am conscious that when I say Europe, really what I mean is the Europe of the Brahmin left. Brahmin left being a Thomas Piketty term. So what we're talking about here is a sort of an intellectual, cultural, liberal Europe.
Yes. Unfortunately, it leaves this group in a rather precarious position because the United States is not just portraying images of decay amongst Europe. It's also interfering in European politics. So J.D. Vance is making contacts with the Reform Party in Britain. Similarly, in Germany, the J.D. Vance is making links to AfD. And I think the Americans will be quite happy to see more right-wing parties succeed. So you can predict and expect that America will continue forming links to the right in Europe and will hope that the right are more successful politically. What can the Brahmin left do about it? I don't think there's much they can do. I mean, I think Europe is now has to realize that they can no longer rely upon America as an ally that looks after their interests. And they're going to have to look after their interests themselves. And we're in for a very difficult time in Europe over the next 10 years.
So Europe very much at a crossroads. You, in your book, outlined three possible scenarios. I'm hoping that you can save the most positive of the three to last and set them out in that order. Give me the worst case scenario from a European perspective.
The worst case scenario from a European perspective is that the United States tries to convert Europe into a vassal state and tries to persuade European countries to basically subsume themselves under, become an American 51st state, get rid of all of their hate speech laws, get rid of all of their restrictions on social media, not put any barriers in favor of American AI. And the Americans are clever enough to realize, well, we probably can't get the whole of Europe to do that. So what we'll do is try and pick off countries one by one. Like if it's not Hungary, maybe it could be Poland, maybe it could be Britain. So the nightmare scenario for Europe is you get Europe splits up and you get some countries will go with the United States in a vassalized form. Other countries might think, well, we need to pull closer to Russia. Other countries might try and strike a deal with China. I think you have to remember that Trump, Xi Jinping and Putin all share a common aim in breaking up Europe. I think it was rather alarming to discover last month that Trump said to Xi Jinping, why don't America, China and Russia all gang up together to destroy the International Criminal Court? So that's one worst. That's probably the worst scenario in my view.
And there's a historical irony to this scenario as well, isn't there? Because what we're talking about is an imperial future. Only Europe is no longer an imperial player.
Europe goes from being an imperialist to an imperialized entity. I think that is a very real possibility that is awaiting Europe. The second option is a sort of a Europe of nation states that it doesn't go as far as this totally vassalized, broken up Europe, but it goes in the form of a Europe with a looser relationship to each other, but more independent nation states. This is a return of the old Gaullist image. And it's I think some of the people on the center right might be happier. It's a rolling back of the European Union to an earlier stage, a looser relationship with each other. And again, I think that's problematic because the Americans are going to just pick and choose between, they're going to practice a divide et impera strategy. And I think that will break down and become the vassalized Europe that I thought was the worst scenario. And then the optimistic strategy is, I think, that Europe manages to take control of its security arrangements and combines security with trade in a new political entity I sometimes refer to as EUTO, an E-U-T-O, that NATO's gone, the EU in its present form is gone, and an arrangement emerges where trade and security and politics are unified in a new entity. But we're a very long way from that, and I think that is the most optimistic.
I am wondering about the hole that America leaves, not just financially and in terms of security, but in terms of our sort of collective imagination, because for better or for worse, it's always been this sort of almost mythological place in people's and in the European imagination, you know, a place of liberty, of freedom, a place to aspire to. With that gone or fragmenting, what are we left with? Like, where would you look to in the sort of collective European imagination for a replacement?
Europe has to look from within. I think that the trouble with Europe, and this is, I think, particularly the case amongst West Germans and Britain even, which have, I think, are more closely tied to this image of a benign America than is the case in France, say. I think Europeans need to wake up and realize that America has changed. America isn't the same entity that it was. Donald Trump is the first president in the post-war era who has said that he is willing to consider the breakup of the EU, encourage it, and same with NATO.
Do you see signs that the image that America is holding up is so naked, so brutal, that there is a European response to actually say, well, actually, no, these are our values and we're going to define them in opposition to what you are projecting?
Yes, I think that is something that's possible and desirable. But the problem, again, is Europe is itself split on those values, right? Because you've got groups in Europe who like MAGA. And I don't think we can ignore that. I mean, there's, you know, 20 to 30% of most European electorates would happily vote for something very similar to what Trump is putting in place. I mean, total return to national sovereignty, get rid of migrants. I mean, the split in the right in Britain is between one party who simply wants to end migration and another party that wants to re-migrate. And I think that Europeans need to recognise that they themselves are split. The Brahmin left are not the only game in town.
Glyn Morgan, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.